Educators want to stay fresh with literacy instruction, but are so busy with students, they don't always have the time. All year long, Choice Literacy publishes and delivers the best K-12 literacy practices so that educators can grow their students as readers and writers with choice in literacy. Welcome to the Big Fresh Choice Literacy Podcast. I'm Ruth Ayers. Practice with the Right Tool by me, Ruth Ayers. Luna, my 10-month-old German Shepherd, and I have been attending obedience class. In an effort to avoid embarrassment, we had a private session before the group class began. I was concerned with Luna's deep and incessant barking and needed direction on how to correct her. The strategies that were working when she was younger were not working as she moved into her adolescent years. The trainer offered a tool. By using a small training collar, I was able to offer Luna correction. Quickly, she was a quiet dog, even when we walked past other dogs or a car zoomed by on a street next to the sidewalk. After a few more weeks, she hushed on command when the doorbell rang or a loud truck barreled down the road. Now, 8 weeks later, we no longer use the training collar daily to correct her barking. In fact, you might even believe that she's naturally a dog who doesn't bark. The members of our basic obedience class will attest that Luna is not a naturally passive dog. She is a reactive dog, and we are trusting that with consistent practice, she will be a quiet dog in any situation. Here's what it made me think. Using the right tool in practice allows for learning to stick. It didn't matter how often I said hush, Luna was not going to stop barking at the doorbell. Once I used the training collar, she figured it out in a few days. After a week of consistent practice, she responded to my verbal correction. Yet, when I take her to obedience class, we use the training collar. It's a different situation, and it takes a little more practice to transfer her learning. When my parents visit, I do not need the training collar. But if a stranger comes to the door, I snap it on. This week, we consider the way we can transfer learning to a variety of situations. Stella Vialba is this month's featured contributor, and we are so excited that she will be taking over the Choice Literacy Instagram feed in the upcoming week. Make sure to follow so that you can catch glimpses of Stella's daily life. Stella is an English learner district teacher leader. We want to wish Mary Lee Hahn a happy retirement. There is a huge virtual celebration happening. You can find out more over on Mary Lee and Frankie Sibberson's blog, A Year of Reading, or by using the hashtags, #MarvelousMaryLee and #PoemsForMaryLee. Please wish her a happy celebration wherever you enjoy posting. We have content from new contributors in the Classic Classroom. Julie Cox is a high school educator from Kentucky. She writes about starting a writer's club in order to help transfer the learning for her students in her high school English class. Naval Karuni Cassiano has a new article inspired by her yoga practice. It is a guide to help us consider the way workshop helps transfer learning. Melanie Meehan joins the podcast. She's an elementary writing and social studies coordinator, and she's written a couple books with Corwin. Her most recent book, The Responsive Writing Teacher, was co-written with Kelsey Sorum and just came out. You can connect with Melanie on Twitter at Melanie Meehan, the number one. Hi, Melanie. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Hi, Ruth. Thanks for having me. It's an honor.
So you have a new article on the site about using pictures to support writers. I'm really excited about this article because it's about scaffolding kids and the way that pictures are just one of the natural ways to help kids enter writing. You opened the article discussing the cognitive demand of writing and how pictures are a natural way to lift some of the heavy load. Can you tell us more about this idea?
Yeah, I love thinking about it that way. I think we forget, or we don't realize, because writing becomes a natural thing for a lot of adults to do, how much work is involved in writing just in terms of brain power. And I don't even mean thinking about ideas or structuring or organizing. I mean just forming letters or remembering how to spell words or thinking about how to match sounds to letters, right? There's so much that's involved in writing, holding a pen and just physically holding the pen and using the strength to hold the pen and move it, finding letters on a keyboard, using the shift button. But there are so many things that are involved in the process of writing that underlie thinking of ideas and writing your sentence and your ideas. So I think that when we can take some of that cognitive work out so that kids can have the cognitive energy go toward whatever part of writing process is difficult for them, it's helpful. And they can practice these other loads of the work, if you will. And part of the work is remembering what you're even writing about. And it's a memory thing. So when there's a picture in front of you that you can keep looking at, then you're not using your brain to constantly be thinking and remembering what it is you're writing about. The picture's there. So you take away that part of the cognitive energy and let it go into some of the other things that are involved. So, you know, that's kind of a brain-based explanation of why I think pictures are such a powerful way to support developing writers and help them really use their energy.
It's so true. I remember one of my very first NCTEs that I ever attended was decades ago, and Don Graves was there, and he talked about watching children. And he sent us back with this like charge or invitation to just sit and watch kids write and notice how much work they were doing. And it really was a changing and a defining moment for me, because I couldn't believe how hard kids were really working. I just remember watching this second grader work to spell a word, and it was like four or five, maybe even more attempts to find the conventional spelling for a word. And then when I looked over his shoulder, I thought, oh my goodness, I would completely enter this conference in helping him with strategies to find a word. And he's just like exhausted every strategy he has. And so you're right. Like, that is just the truth of writing. And I love the way you just said, as adults, sometimes we forget just the heavy lifting that we do as writers.
Yeah, like what's natural for us isn't natural for them. What's easy for us and what's muscle memory or brain memory isn't. And I think that when we can just make some parts of it easier, it's a great thing to do, because then you can practice the hard parts.
Yes. So your article, Melanie, the first time I read the draft of your article, I was so impressed the way that you organized it according to some different modes of writing. So you were talking about using pictures in informational, narrative, and opinion writing. So I'd love to spend some time talking about how you're shifting the use of pictures according to each genre, or according to the genre. Yeah. How do you use pictures to support informational writing?
You know, I think I was initially inspired because of one of the units that we use from Teachers College, the Looking Closely unit, where kindergartners have objects that they study and they write about those objects. So you can pick up a pine cone or an acorn or a leaf and notice the details of it and write about those details. Which, like, ultimately, that's what I want as writers, right? Like, as a writer, I walk around and notice the details of life. Like, that's my modus operandi. I want to dig in and see what maybe other people don't see. So picking that object up and holding it and concretely examining it and writing about those details that you see is a way to, in a Piaget kind of exploration way, of concrete to abstract moved kids. And pictures seems like a natural bridge in that movement from a concrete object to an abstract thought of, here is a picture that I can write about. So one of the things that I will do is I will listen to a child and hear what's important and what they do. And a great example, and I think I wrote about this one in the article, is in our town, we have a farm that everybody loves. And I was listening to a child who was struggling with finding a topic, and he was talking about his adventures at Flammig Farm. So I just went on the internet and grabbed a picture of Flammig Farm, and he could write about it. And because that picture was right in front of him of the barns and the buildings, he could write about the barns and the buildings. And when he was out of ideas, and again, he couldn't use his brain to conjure up, he could look at the picture and have the picture right there for him to write about and describe the buildings. So it was, you know, combining what that child was interested and loved in and loved with a concrete image that he could use to support himself as a writer. What has been really nice about the transfer of it is watching a student, and this was in a second grade student, which this kid was, but watching a fourth and fifth grade student say to me, I could really use a picture of that. If I find a picture, I could write about it. And I love that, because that's them transferring the idea and the concept, right? Like, yeah, you can find your own picture and write about it. And then it's not even me giving it to them. It's them taking that initiative and transferring it that way. So that's one of the ways that I use information, or use pictures in information writing.
Yeah. And when they're asking for the picture, they're completely internalizing that work of a nonfiction writer, where you need to be specific. And the more specific and small we can write about a topic, you know, the more that the reader can learn. And I was just thinking about the way those pictures, because of the internet, there's nothing in the world that kids don't have access to.
No.
When it comes to informational topics.
Right. And it, you know, for me as a writer, going and finding a picture can help me. There's nothing wrong with doing that and recognizing that that is a scaffold that helps you. And how great is it that you can find your own scaffold and create it for yourself as a writer?
Yeah, it is true. I know I do the same thing. I really like to find pictures and images that help me understand my topic more, or when I'm writing narrative, get to know the story and the scenes a little bit more. So you write about narrative writing and using pictures in narrative writing. And I think I love this section so much, Melanie, because you moved it from, like, it's not giving kids a picture so that they, and assigning them to write a story. You're really using pictures, teaching them how to use a picture as a tool as a writer. So I'm just so excited to hear you talk a little bit more about pictures and narrative writing.
So pictures with narrative writing, I think, is the most complicated one for me to talk about, because really my goal is that kids find stories in their lives, and that their lives inspire them to write stories, and they become experts at noticing those stories and realizing that they're worth it. They're worth the writing. But that's a process. And I think the best analogy I have, and I'm going to start with, is if we are, when I was teaching my kids to ride a bike, they had their training wheels and they had me, and sometimes I would get them started on the bike, and they couldn't get on and they couldn't get started themselves. But if I got them started, they could keep going and build their confidence. And eventually they got to the point where they got on themselves and rode their bikes. And what I've been finding is that 3 to 5 panel comics are a really fabulous entry point for writers, taking out the pressure of finding the story and planning the story, because those comics give writers a story, right? Like if we have a 3 panels little comic strip of a guy throwing a ball into the ocean for the dog and the dog chasing after it and bringing it back, there's a story there and it's like writable. But what is happening is that that kid is writing the story that somebody else has sort of created and thought about it. And I really want the student to someday be able to create their own story in their own lives, but they have to also have the skills of writing a story. And this comic strip will give them the practice of writing the story and give them the courage to write stories while they're not able to come up with their own story. And because they're developing the courage of writing a story and also experiencing kind of that dopamine effect of entertaining people with their stories, they're like, wow, I'm a storyteller. They become more motivated and engaged and have more agency in finding the stories in their lives. So that has been my favorite way of using pictures in narrative writing, is to really use those comics as scaffolds that support students' understanding of beginning, middle, and end, support them writing a story with development, and give them the courage to find the stories in their own lives. It's a long answer, but I think it's complex work.
Melanie, it's so wise just to think about kids and how we can just support them as writers. As you were talking, I was also thinking about just Maslow's hierarchy of need and how the creation process is right there at the tip top. So in order to build kids' confidence and just let them know that it's safe to write a story, sometimes it's too big of a leap to write about stories from their own lives, and just giving them pictures and comics really help support that.
Yeah. You know, it was a really cool thing that happened with this was just last week. I was working with sixth graders, and this was a group of sixth grade boys who had a lot of frustrating experiences in their writing history with narrative writing. And so comics were really helping them, and they were really loving the idea that they could be funny. And I have a collection of comics that I just put in front of kids and I let them choose, because I am a big believer in choice. But one of them said, could I go find my own comic and write about that? And I was like, yeah, go find your own comic and write about that. And, you know, it that's like part of that internalization of the process, and the part of that scaffold kind of being weaned, that he's not using my comic, he's going and finding his own. And eventually that I have confidence that he'll find his own stories.
Great
in his
point.
Life.
And Melanie, just to kind of clarify for readers, so you're saying, like, I'm giving kids a comic and it's really for the plot line. And then are you having kids write comics themselves, or are you having them write like a narrative with paragraphs and stretching out that comic or that plot line from the comic?
The second that you're saying. So I will give them the comic for the plot line, for the really clear beginning, middle, and end structure that a comic offers, just in a series of panels. And it's what's really beautiful about it is that a lot of comics, and Snoopy works well, the dog comics work really well, there's the penguin comics that work well, but they have very clear beginning, middle, and ends to them, so students can lean on those for their structure so that they can understand the beginning, middle, and end, the establishment of characters and setting, the weaving in of dialogue and description and action, even inner thinking. One of my favorite things to do is to ask them to tell the stories from different perspectives. And then it even builds in that perspective taking, which is such an important part of social justice and becoming an empathetic human being. So there's a lot that you can do in terms of asking students to write the storylines behind comics.
And just push, you know, continuing to help them grow their understanding of how a narrative is crafted. Mm-hmm. And I was just thinking about the student you described who said, well, can I go find my own comic? Because really, that's one more step closer to him developing his own topic when he's out there searching for that. What a nice illustration of supporting young writers. Mm-hmm. All right, let's switch gears and talk about using pictures for opinion writing. What are some of your thoughts around images to help students become more confident in taking a stance in writing?
You know, so again, with the information writing, I talked about finding pictures of places or of things that are interesting to kids. And I think that in terms of finding pictures that are going to be used for opinion writing, it's even more important to find pictures that are going to be interesting to kids. So I do a lot of kid listening and kid watching and kid asking questions so that I know what matters to them. And then I get series of pictures that kids can choose from what's my favorite one in this series of pictures. I think one of my best examples, again, was just from the last week, where I had a student who was, he just wasn't coming up with any topic at all for his opinion writing. He was the master of, I don't have anything. I got nothing. I don't like anything. All right. But I knew he was a runner. So I got 5 pictures of sneakers and just did a quick screenshot of 5 different sneakers. And I could put those up in front of him in terms of which was the best pair of sneakers. And then he could talk about that. What was even more powerful with this student, and the teacher was out at recess duty, listening to the boys talking and debating whether Tesla was better or a Maserati, which was the better car. And I was able to grab screenshots that had just a couple key data points between those two cars and put those up in front of him. And he could speak to really with information and facts and details and specifics, because it was included in this little snip of a picture of the Tesla, that the Tesla was the better car, and explain it. And he loved doing that, but he was leaning on the picture in order to do that. And from that conversation, I was able to kind of nudge him with different techniques and different thinking prompts and ways to explain his thinking. And he could transfer his conversation and his thoughts into writing, which he had never done before. But it was the power of that picture and the concrete in front of him that let him move from the abstract process of thinking about what he likes the best to writing about it.
It was the picture, and it was also like the teacher noticing what his interest was and helping position him to do that writing.
What was really important and what really mattered is that the teacher was spending some time listening and reacting and sharing and using what she knew about him and what mattered to him in order to find a topic that really would work.
Melanie, this just segues so well into our last question. And that's about your new book. So I am so excited for you. You just had a new book come out this year, and it's called The Responsive Writing Teacher. Do you mind telling us a little bit about it?
I'd love to tell you about it. So The Responsive Writing Teacher is a book that I co-wrote with Kelsey Sorum, who was a colleague with me with 2 writing teachers, and she's a kindergarten and first grade teacher in Brooklyn. And it came out of the fact that the toolkits that we were making were toolkits that were for the students in front of us. They weren't toolkits that could be copied. It was the thought process that could be copied and used. So we structured the book really with four domains that center it and serve as the pillars throughout the book. Knowing kids in terms of their academics, like where are they academically? Knowing kids in terms of language, like what are their language skills? What are, if they're multilingual, how can we capitalize on that? What supports can we offer them that help them use language more precisely? Then we have our cultural responsiveness, where we really work to understand how students think at home and how to bring that into the classroom and use that. And then finally, the social emotional responsiveness. Those two last ones really combine to do things like knowing that the cars matter to kids, right? Like, how do we really know and pay attention to kids and what matters to them? So throughout the book, we lean into those four domains, but we talk about the different elements of writing instruction. So whether that's planning or assessment or choosing mentor texts or creating demonstration texts, like how do we use those four domains to do anything as it relates to writing? And then maybe the most important is how do we empower the kids to have agency in their own writing lives? So at some point, kids are going to become writers on their own without us. And how do we create the systems and the structures so that they have the courage to go out and do that? So it was a really fun book to think about and write and create.
I've read the introduction and I'm fascinated about the way you've structured this response we can offer student writers. And I can't wait to dig in a little bit more. So it's the responsive writing teacher from Corwin. Well, Melanie, it's been great getting to know you a little bit more. And I'm so glad that you made some time to talk with us on the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me, Ruth.
At Choice Literacy, we know that you want to be an educator who makes students' lives better through literacy. In order to do that, you need access to comprehensive literacy practices delivered in a way you will actually use. With over 150 in-the-field contributors, we understand the pressure to reach a variety of needs and not enough time to do it, which is why we hold true to workshop tenets like choice and share practical ways to plan and deliver literacy instruction straight to the point of student need. You can find links to all of the articles discussed in the show notes or sign up for the Big Fresh so you can have the links delivered directly to your inbox. Keep growing readers and writers by offering choice in literacy.